talking about Job, a man of mystery. And I think we can make this tie in with the fact that there are things that happen in our lives for which we must be thankful, even the bad stuff. Now, that's hard, to be grateful for things that challenge us, because we'd like everything nice and easy, nice and smooth. I read for you the last time a statement out of Erdman's Handbook of the Bible concerning Job. And I want to remind you of that statement, because this mystery man and this mystery book has many views about it, many concepts. I'm going to also read to you later out of the Judaica, the Encyclopedia Judaica, because it has some interesting observations of the various ideas that exist about Job. Last time I read this to you, the subject is as old as the hills and as modern as the space age. If God is just and good, why does God let innocent people suffer? This rabbi, and Rabbi Kushner, that's his name, who wrote a book entitled Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. We've all had our observations about that, and perhaps we've even experienced it ourselves, where we really see no reason why things happen to us personally or to those that we love. We just can't explain it. We can't figure it out. And the book of Job is all about that. The writer goes on here to say, why the casual victims of war and terrorism? Now, this was written some time ago, before America experienced terrorism to the degree that it has. But why does that happen? Why the dying child of cancer, the child dying of cancer, why that? As a man, Job is really, and this is in italics in this writing, really good. And we know some of those really good people. About the best any man could ever hope to be. Yet calamity overwhelms him. Loss of possessions and family is followed by grim, prolonged physical suffering that shakes his faith to the depths. And that happens in the lives of many people. Many situations and circumstances arise. So just reminding you that the book of Job starts out by telling us something very interesting. It tells us a little bit about him, and he was a real person. Remember, we looked in the book of Ezekiel, because Ezekiel makes a reference to him. There is a reference in the book of Genesis to a Job, whether that was the same Job who's part of the Israelitish clan going into Egypt when Joseph was there and so forth. We don't know if that's the same Job or not. There is speculation about it, but to nail it down as to when he lived and that kind of thing, we don't know. We do know that he dwelt in a real place called Uz. There's a reference in the book, two references, one in the book of Jeremiah and one in the book of Lamentations about this land of Uz. Some time ago, I remember hearing that this great Job character was filled with such wisdom and so forth, he was sometimes called the Wizard of Uz, which gets perverted to the Wizard of Oz, obviously. That's a possibility. He may have had certain wisdom and certain abilities that drew people to him. He was a real person who dwelt in a real place. Now, to confirm his realness, just turn with me to the book of James. There's a statement made in the fifth chapter of James that gives us concrete evidence that Job was a real person. So here is James, the half-brother of Jesus Christ, in his epistle here, writing in the 5th chapter in verse 11, saying, behold, we count them happy which endure. So what is he talking about? He's setting up a basis then for enduring whatever it is that comes upon us, and he takes a moment to suggest that in this endurance there is an example that we can turn to. He says further, you have heard of the patience of Job. Connected then with endurance, is this character Job, this individual Job. Now, we've got a whole book of 42 chapters about this character of Job and the issue of endurance and the issue of patience. It goes on to say, and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy. Now, this is very instructive because the end of the Lord in connection with Job was God's appearance to Job in chapter 38 of the book of Job, and a series of questions that were put to him. We'll get to that in the next sermon on it. But God appears to Job and in the end shows that he is pitiful, full of pity, and he is merciful, as he expressed it towards Job himself, and the fact that Job had to endure it to see it. He couldn't see it up front, even in his righteousness, even in things going so well for him. He was wealthy. He was well-known. Prosperous is the term, I guess. He was pious. He was all those things. And yet there was something that God had in mind for Job. We learn in the first chapter, just as a reminder, that it was not Satan who brought up the idea of attacking Job. It wasn't a neighbor who prayed to God that you bring Job down, give him something that will really cause him to suffer and be in agony. That wasn't what happened. God himself brought Job to the attention of the devil. Now that is worth thinking about. Because while we maybe, you know, try to minimize, you know, Satan's involvement in our lives and so forth, the reality is he's a real being. And that he is an instrument in God's hand to accomplish God's purposes. Now, Satan has a blind spot, a huge blind spot, because he hates humanity so much. He would like to destroy us so much that if God gives him permission to do something that would hurt or harm us in any kind of way, personally, individually, or collectively as human beings, he will do that. But God has limitations imposed upon him, as in the case of Job. When he brings, and just a reminder, when he brings Job to the attention of Satan, God limits what Satan can do. First, he limited him by saying, you can take everything he has. That means money, material gain. All of those things can be subject to the devil's taking if God permits. So how do people lose money? How do they lose stocks and bonds and thieves break through and steal? Didn't Jesus say that? Seek ye first the kingdom of God and all of its righteousness. Don't lay not up for yourselves treasure upon earth where dust, moths and dust doth corrupt and thieves break through and steal, because it is subject to being taken away. Right? So God permits that to happen to Job, including his sons and his daughters, seven sons and three daughters, I believe the figure is. All of his possessions, all of his camels and all of his herds taken away. And yet, Job, in his piety, does not curse God or lay the blame at God's feet for this situation. Very tragic, to be certain. Satan comes back to God and says, well, you know, I made the argument before that if you take everything he has, he'll curse you to your face. Well, the reason he hasn't cursed you, and this is Satan's thinking, the reason he hasn't cursed you is that, you know, he still has his health. And comedians and philosophers talk about the fact that if you have your health, you've got everything. You are a wealthy person if you have your health. You may be poor, but if you have your health, you're all right. And so God says to Satan, all right, touch his body. You know, make him hurt. Make him agonize. Make him suffer in the flesh. But you can't take his life. Because God is in control, though Satan likes to think that he is. He permits him to take the health from Job. And yet, in the last verse of chapter 1, this statement is made, in all this, Job sinned not and charged God, nor charged God foolishly. And I said on the last occasion that I have written in my margin, yet. yet. Because if you read the book of Job foolishly, you will find some very pithy sayings that arise throughout the book, and you take them out of context, you can make them say what they really are not saying. It's easy to do that, and I'll show you that before we finish today. Very easy to do that with the book of Job. The 14th chapter comes to mind in particular, which is used in funerals continually about the resurrection. But in the context of Job's talking about it, it means something entirely different. There's truth in what he's saying there. It's okay to use those scriptures, but you've got to put it in the context of what Job was agonizing about. So at this point in time, when that statement is written, and this is, of course, before Satan's second attack, Job does not charge God or sin against God foolishly at all. But he's going to have some things to say. Just as a reminder then, in chapter 2, for 7 days and seven nights, Job, when everything is at its worst situation, the worst possible circumstance, at the nadir of his existence, he sits quietly for 7 days and seven nights. His three friends come and sit with him. And this is an instruction for us in the times of tragedy when we go to see people who have had some serious things brought against them. There's a tendency to talk. To just talk. You feel like you got to say something, right? And most times we say the wrong things. I understand. Well, we probably don't. We don't understand, you know, what's happening with the person. But we say it because we like to talk. Now, to the three friends' credit, they came and saw how grief-stricken Job was, and he wasn't saying anything, so they sat down and didn't say anything either. The first person to speak was Job. Now, that really helps when you go into tragedy to let the person who has the tragedy upon them, if they can speak, speak. Because it will give you some direction on what to say and how to be a comfort to them. But when you're just spouting off and, you know, just saying all the platitudes that you can think of, oh, it's going to be all right, and God understands, you know, all the things that we say. Meaning well, good intentioned and all of that, but just take a look there at the end of the second chapter. Nothing is said. They sat down and they waited. Then in chapter 3, Job begins to speak. Now, from chapter 3 through chapter 31, we've got three disputes or three debates that happen. I'm only going to look at the first one, the first series, because each one is simply really the same kind of thing. It just gets deeper and deeper into the discussion. But there are three debates that go on. Job is the first to respond, and his friends then respond to what he says, and he then in turn responds to the things that they have to say. And let's take a look then to see in these three places, this first in the series of the debates or arguments that go on. I mentioned last time that Job, in this first time he opens his mouth, you would think this righteous man would say something more than this, but look at what he says. Let the day, verse 3, chapter 3, let the day perish wherein I was born. Now, I'm not going to ask anybody to raise their hands and tell me whoever said, I wish I wasn't born. or put it this way, I wish I was dead. Everybody in here has had something happen in your life where you've said that, where you've hoped for that, that you wish that would happen. Even if it's something as simply as bad as a toothache. Have you ever had a toothache, a serious kind of toothache where you feel like slamming your head against the wall to make it stop? But just magnify that and multiply that into the serious agony that happens within our minds over situations and circumstances that come to our lives. So here Job is saying, let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it was said, this man, child, is conceived. Let the day be darkness. Let not God regard it above, from above, neither let the light shine upon it. Now, this is a man in deep depression, in deep difficulty. And he goes on and spouts like that through the entirety of the chapter, which elicits now a response from his friends. Eliphaz, Zophar, and Bildad. Here they are. They came to see their friend who they heard about in trouble. Now, in chapter 4 is where Eliphaz begins to speak. And it's an interesting thing that happens, and this is why this is so instructive for us. They made a conclusion based on their experience, based on their observation, that it is impossible for the innocent to suffer. That was the argument that Eliphaz is going to produce here for us. Job, I'm telling you, I mean, you're whining and crying here about, you know, you wish you were dead and so forth, but what's happened to you couldn't have happened because you're innocent. Now, fess up. What have you done? What have you done to bring this on yourself? You must have done something, Job, because the innocent, look at verse 7. Remember, I pray you, this is chapter 4, verse 7. Remember, I pray you, whoever perished being innocent? Or where were the righteous cut off? Job, you've been out here, you've been sacrificing for your kids just in case, you know, they might have committed a sin. You're pious, you give, you do all these kinds of things. You've got some secret sins, my buddy. That's what Eliphaz is saying. You got something that you're hiding. Now just fess up. Confession is good for the soul. It's basically the argument that Eliphaz is using. Now, this sets the tone of how they respond to Job, his three friends. It goes on just like that through the three stages of arguments. That there is something about you, Eliphaz, that's not right. Verse 8. Even as I have seen, that is, you know, from my observation, the things that I have seen in life, even as I have seen, they that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same. So what's happened to you, Job? You've lost all your stuff. Your health has gone south. Something is of your making. It's something that you've done. Verse 9. By the blast of God, they perish. And by the breath of his nostrils, they are consumed. The roaring of the lion and the voice of the fierce lion and the teeth of the young lions are broken. The old lion perishes for lack of prey, and the stout lion's whelps are scattered abroad. Now, a thing was secretly brought to me. Now, Eliphaz is going to tell him about this vision, this dream, or whatever he has, when some being, you know, something came to him and began to show him this truth that he's sharing now with his friend. And it's very interesting. He says, you know, secretly it was brought to me, my ear received a little thereof. Verse 13, in thoughts from the visions of the night when deep sleep falls on men, fear came upon me and trembling, which made all my bones to shake. Then a spirit passed by before my face. Now, when you start talking like this to people, you know, they pretty well want to lock you up, you know. Even you seeing spirits? Well, look at what happened. Here's Eliphaz in the scriptures speaking about a spirit. You know, something came to me in the night. You want to call it a dream? You want to call it a vision? Whatever you want to call it. The old folk I used to hear about talking about these things, the kids used to hear them talking about it and thought they were crazy. Well, Eliphaz had an experience that he's relating now to Job. It stood still, but I could not discern the form thereof. Verse 16, an image was before mine eyes. There was silence, and I heard a voice saying, this is what it said, shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his maker? Behold, he put no trust in his servants, and his angels he charged with folly. How much less in them that dwell in houses of clay? How much less are human beings than the great beings like angels that God has created, is what this spirit must have said, or claims to have said, to Eliphaz, whose foundation is the dust, which are crushed before the moth. They are destroyed from the morning to evening. They perish forever without any regard. Does not their excellency, which is in them, go away? They die even without wisdom. This is the human condition, is what Eliphaz is saying. So, you've done something secret. I had this dream, and I'm telling you that what's happening to you is what happens to everybody. Because everybody has sin, is basically what Eliphaz is saying to him. And he continues in chapter 5 with his argument to stipulate that God is faithful. While human beings do their craziness and so forth, God, despite what is happening to you, is faithful. Verse 8 says in chapter 5, I would seek unto God, and unto God would I commit my cause, which does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number, who gives rain upon the earth and sends water upon the fields, to set up on high those that be low, that those which mourn may be exalted to safety. He disappoints the devices of the crafty, so that their hands cannot perform their enterprise. So God is faithful even when we are not. That's the argument Eliphaz is giving. And it goes on like this, but now Job has to respond. You know, when you're talking back and forth, everybody has to have their say. So Job is sitting listening to Eliphaz, and he doesn't agree with what Eliphaz is saying about this situation in which he finds himself. So he responds in chapter 6. And he pleads for pity. Verse 9. Even that it would please God to destroy me, that he would let loose his hand and cut me off. There's that same theme back in chapter 3. I've cursed the day I was born. I wish I was dead. Remember the old little song that we used to sing as children? Nobody likes me. Everybody hates me because I eat worms. You know, this moaning, groaning, pitiful being. And all of us reach a place in our lives sometimes when we're so pitiful, I mean, with a capital P, that it's just depressing to be around us. You know what I mean? And you do your best to get us out of it, but that is the human condition. So here's Job in his response. Yeah, I'm pitiful. Verse 14, he says, to him that is afflicted, pity should be showed for his friend. For he forsakes the fear of the Lord, of the Almighty. You know, be pitiful upon me. Have pity on me. You know, mourn with me, groan with me because of all that I'm going through. And so here's this exercise in going through and listening to Job respond to Eliphaz. Look at chapter 7, verse 7. Oh, remember that my life is wind. Mine eyes shall see no more, shall see no more, see good. Now, there's another reference later on that one of the speakers, one of his friends says about this wind thing. I think we'll get to that here in a moment. But, you know, wind, you can't see it. Life is wind. Well, you can't see it. It's just kind of here and it's gone. You feel the effect of it, but it can't stay. You can't harness it. It's basically what he's saying. The eye of him in verse 8 that sees me shall see me no more. Thine eyes are upon me, and I am not. The cloud is consumed and vanishes away, so that so he that goes down to the grave shall come up no more. Now this is different than what he says in chapter 14 about going into the grave. But right now he is so teed off and so disappointed and so upset, and his friends are not helping him. They're not pitiful enough for him, you see. Verse 13, when I say, my bed shall comfort me, my couch shall cease my complaint, then you scare me with dreams and terrify me with visions. Eliphaz, I mean, I'm looking for pity from you, and you tell me about this dream, this ghost who shows up at your place and tells you all this strange stuff. Verse 15, so that my soul chooses strangling and death rather than my life. I loathe it. I would not live always. Let me alone, for my days are vanity. Then verse 17, the same kind of thing that David said in Psalm 8. What is man that you should magnify him and that you should set thine heart upon him? And this is the attitude that Job has. Now, just pause for a moment. What is your image of Job based on what we read in James 5 and verse 11? The patience of Job. Oh, what a mighty man of great, long-lasting patience. Oh, a great endurance. Is it consistent with what we're reading with his words? No, it's not. It's not. So we have to understand James 5 and verse 11 in the process that gets to patience. Because this is not a patient man we're reading about here. He is so impatient and so antagonized by his friends, and God hadn't even said anything to him yet. But his friends are there. They're trying to help him. They're trying to get him to see. Look at what Bildad does in chapter 8. He's the second speaker, second friend to speak. He starts out in verse 2 by saying, "How long will you speak these things? And how long shall the words of your mouth be like a strong wind?" Now, I mentioned that the word wind would come up again. I don't know how to put this, a blowhard. It's probably a person who's just spouting off, always just spouting off, blowing wind. You know, just spouting off all the time. That's what Bildad tells Job. How long are you going to be spouting off with all your great knowledge? Does God pervert judgment, or does the Almighty pervert justice? If your children have sinned against him, and he have cast them away from their transgression, if you would seek unto God many times, or be times, and make your supplication to see the Almighty, if you were pure and upright, Job, surely now he would awake for you and make the habitation of your righteousness prosperous. Job, you're the problem, Job. And really, in the face of adversity and situations, that is the common assumption. It bothers me a lot of times that people make blanket statements about the homeless and the dispossessed. Well, they just don't want to work. How do you know that? Have you interviewed them all? But there's an assumption about people in destitute situations that, you know, they just choose to live that way. They don't want to be responsible. They just kind of want to live on the streets and, you know, not have a job and hold a job. You just don't know what is happening in their lives or what happened to bring them to that point. Now, is that true of some of them? Oh, yeah. But all of them? And so we make these blanket statements and condemnations and judgments about why it is that people are suffering and the conditions in which they find themselves. We look at the third world, for instance, and we say, well, those people in the third world, you know, who are not like the first world tier of people where we have all these blessings in America and the Western world, but, you know, the third world people, they just don't have the same get up and go that we have. They don't have the same desires and the same ambitions and the same drive that we have. Well, we just make those kind of blanket statements, not realizing that God, who sits high and looks low, has a plan unfolding and mapping out in the lives of individuals as well as in the lives of a collective on this earth. And we have to be careful about making such statements as this. So here Bildad gives his first speech, and he tells Job, you know, wise up, lighten up, maybe shut up your mouth. But Job can't do that. Chapter 9, he responds. And he responds in verse 2 by saying, "I know it is so of a truth, but how should man be just with God?" You know what he's saying? Nobody can be just before God. Who can be righteous before God? Look at verse 20 here in chapter 9. He says it again. "If I justify myself, mine own mouth shall condemn me. If I say I am perfect, it shall also prove me perverse." I cannot be justified before God. So you're trying to get me, Bildad, to justify myself before God. I can't do it. I mean, God is doing this. He's done this thing to me, and I don't know why he's done it. I don't understand why he's called me to have this suffering. I don't understand it. So he then waxes eloquent for chapters 9 and through 10. He states that both the righteous and the wicked suffer in chapter 10. Let's take a look at that, chapter 10. It says, "My soul is weary of my life." Verse 1, "I will leave my complaint upon myself. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say unto God, do not condemn me. Show me whereof you contend with me." Why have you done this? And this is the agony or the journey that a person who is suffering has to go on. I put it down this way. It is a journey. Let's see if my eye falls on it. Yeah, Job's journey to self-justification. Journey to self-justification. God, I don't know why you've done this. Verse 3. It is good unto you that you should oppress, that you should despise the work of your hands, and shine upon the counsel of the wicked. You see what Job didn't know? Is that Satan was doing it. But he attributed it to God. I think it's dangerous to attribute things of God to Satan and vice versa. It's a dangerous thing to do that, but we do it all the time because we're not looking behind the scenes. We're not seeing what's going on and what God's purposes might be for us as individuals or as a group. We're not seeing it. I'm going to break in here for a moment and turn to a passage in Isaiah. Because what Job does not grasp, and what so many people who go through suffering and difficulty don't seem to grasp, is what we find in Isaiah 55. Look at verse 7. God ultimately wants those of us who are sinners, which I think includes all of us, to turn from our wicked ways. Here's how it's written in Isaiah 55 and verse 7. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Now, we've seen from Job his thoughts. And if we were to read from chapters 3 through 31, we'd see a lot of things that Job thought in response to what his friends are saying, in response to his own psyche. But God wants the righteous man, the unrighteous man, to forsake his thoughts and let him return unto the Lord, and he will have mercy upon him and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. But you see, Job is looking at it like this. I don't have anything to be pardoned for. God is just unjust about this. I haven't done anything. Why should I be suffering? I'm a righteous person. I go to church every week. I tithe of all I possess. I fast twice in the week. You know, there was somebody who said that that Jesus talked about at the temple. I think Luke 15 is where you find it, where the Pharisee goes up to the temple to pray. And those are the things that the Pharisee said. I'm righteous. I'm not like this publican over here, you know, who is the lowest and the lowest of the low. I'm not like that. So why are these things happening to me? It goes on to say in verse 8, chapter 55 of Isaiah, verse 8, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, says Yahweh, says the Eternal, says the Lord. Now, that is what a person has to consider when you're going through whatever it is you're going through. What's God's purpose? What's his plan? Because if you take the road that this is not fair, why is this happening to me? I don't deserve this. I deserve to be happy. I deserve to be wealthy and wise and all the things that people talk about. It says in verse 9, for as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Now that's where human beings have to come to. And that is where Job had to be brought to. And the mechanism to bring Job to that place by God was the use of his attack by Satan on Job's person and his property. So why are things happening to us? What's the situation? What kind of influence comes upon us? What kind of wiles of the devil happens? Now, the New Testament is filled with things about knowing how the devil works. You know, we're not ignorant of his devices, Paul wrote. We must be aware of the wiles of the devil because he is real, and especially for those of the household of faith, he is going to be active. He's going to want to bring us down. And God sits and he looks and he says, okay, now what do I want for that person, that son or that daughter of mine? What What will bring them to a place where they begin to imbibe of my thoughts and my way of thinking? Will I have to take all their possessions away? Will I have to take a loved one away? Will I have to touch their body and bring them down to a place where they can hear me and see me and come to a reality of me? Is that what I have to do? If I have to do that, I can do that. I've got this individual over here who thinks he's all that. You know, this Satan being, this adversary, he's just champing at the bit to get at you guys, so I'll just limit him. I'll allow him to do a few things because it's part of what I want to have accomplished. And this is how we have to begin to consider and to think about the circumstances of life, even as a nation. We have to think of it in those terms because didn't God, remember the time, I think it's 1 Chronicles 21, when David had been told by Nathan, don't number Israel. Don't take a census to see how many people you got to go out to war and to fight a battle. God says don't do it. Well, it tells us in 1 Chronicles 21 that Satan moved David to number Israel. Really? A man after God's own heart, a man who wrote all those magnificent psalms, a man who prostrated himself before God. You mean Satan could get in on David? Well, he certainly did with Bathsheba, didn't he? And he got him to go against a direct command of God through the prophet Nathan not to number Israel. Satan is a real being and is used of God variously to bring about his plan for us. Now, Zophar, the third friend here in chapter 11, begins to make his charge. And he dares, he looks at Job and says, Job, how dare you claim your innocence? Look at verses 4 through 8. Verse 4 says, for you have said, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in mine eyes. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips against you, that he would show you the secrets of wisdom, that they are double to that which is. Know therefore that God exacts of you less than thine iniquity deserves. You know, what's happening to you, Job? You deserve worse. That's how his friends are talking to him. And sometimes we may be that blunt with some of our friends, you know, and declaring, I don't know what you're complaining about. It could be worse than that. We could say. Verse 7. Can you by searching find out God? Can you find out the Almighty unto perfection? It is as high as heaven. What can you do? Deeper than hell. What can you know? But yet we are told when we read Isaiah that we can, well, we're told there that God's thoughts are higher than ours and, you know, we can't figure it out. But we're going to come back to a verse that I purposely left out in that passage that will tell us that the journey in our destination requires that we do some seeking. We do some seeking. Now, Zophar has his saying, his charges, and so forth. Job gives his rebuttal. He says, the wicked are not immediately punished. I mean, I look around and I see that I'm a righteous person, and look at what's happening to me. But the wicked, look at verse 6 of chapter 12. Let's start at verse 1. Chapter 12 and verse 1. Job answered and said, no doubt, but you are the people, and wisdom shall die with you. When you guys are so smart, when you die, wisdom will be gone. But I have understanding as well as you. I am not inferior to you. Yes, who knows not such things as these? I am as one mocked of his neighbor, who calls upon God and he answers him. The just, upright man is laughed to scorn. That's me, Job says. He that is ready to slip with his feet as a lamp despised in the thought of him that is at ease. The tabernacle of robbers prosper, and they that provoke God are secure, into whose hands God brings abundantly. Didn't Jesus say something about that? David even wrote a psalm about it, Psalm 37, where he says, fret not ourselves because of evildoers. Or Jesus said, the sun shines on the just and the unjust. There is prosperity among the unjust. People who are ripping folk off, stealing and conniving and manipulating Wall Street and passing legislation for cronies and buddies, people who have greased their palms with bribes and, campaign contributions, excuse me. I used the word bribes. I was mistaken. Campaign contributions. So people prosper. And so Job says, this is not right. This is not right. It's the same observation that Solomon makes in the book of Ecclesiastes. You know, I compiled, he says, you can compile wealth in your life, and when you die, your son or your daughter comes along and ruins everything by foolishness. And Job makes this observation. Now, this is a journey to be certain, to be agonizingly gone through. But in the midst of Job's rebuttal, the rebuttal is where we started in chapter 12 to what Zophar, the third speaker, has to say. We come to this chapter 14. I want to bring us to this place because so much is said here in this chapter. But if we put it in the context of Job's dismay, his depression, we can extract the wisdom from it, but we have to keep it in the context. He says in chapter 14 and verse 1, man that is born of woman is of a few days and full of trouble. Now, would Job have said that before all his stuff was taken away and his health was challenged? No, he wouldn't have said that. He comes forth like a flower and is cut down. He flees also as a shadow and continues not. And do you open your eyes upon such a one and bring me into judgment with you? Who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean? Not one. Speaking on the human level, you can't do it. Seeing his days are determined, the number of his months are with you, and you've appointed his bounds, and he cannot pass. Now he's speaking of the fact that God has limitations upon human beings. And he's telling his friends that. Turn upon him, turn from him in verse 6, that he may rest till he shall accomplish as an hireling his day. For there is hope of a tree. If it's cut down, then it will sprout again, and the tender branch thereof will not cease. Though the root thereof waxes old in the earth, and the stalk thereof dies in the ground, yet you put a little water on it, the scent of water, just the presence of water, and it will bud and bring forth boughs like a plant. But a man, a human being, this is Job's perspective on life. A man dies and wastes away, yes, man gives up the ghost, gives up his breath, and where is he? What happens to him? Now this is the view of a person who is absolutely besides himself. So he goes on to say, and the water falls, fails upon the sea, or from the sea, and the flood decays and dries up. So man lies down and rises not till the heavens be no more. They shall not awake, nor be raised out of their sleep, these people who are dead. Now that is a fact, as far as Job is concerned. But then he says in verse 13, oh, that you, God, would hide me in the grave, that you would keep me secret until your wrath be past, that you would appoint me a set time and remember me. Now, this is a supplication, and it's a perspective that I think bears consideration. What Job is arriving at is this. If I die, and what I've observed from human beings dying, they are no more. A tree, you can cut off the branches, you could even cut it off at the roots, but if you put a little water around it, it's going to sprout again. But human beings, They're done. They're fini. That's it. But I'm making a request of you. Here's Job spouting and thinking in the depths of his life. He's thinking and considering that God might respond to this request, that if your anger is past, I hope that you will remember me. Verse 14, then this famous verse that's used in sermons or in funerals all over. If a man die, shall he live again? Is death the end? If the things that I suffer ultimately leads to death, is that it? as Peggy Lee sang, "Is that all there is?" You see? "All the days of my appointed time will I wait. If you put me in the grave by all this process that you're taking me through," is what he's saying, "if you do that, I'm going to await all the days of my appointed time till my change comes." Change from what? Well, from death to life. Because if I die, I'm going to have to wait till your time limit is up, God. Whatever your time limit is for me, I got to wait there. I can't do anything. I can't visit anybody. I can't enjoy the pleasures of my family and friends and the wealth and things I've accumulated. I'm dead. That's it. I got to wait. So he goes on to say, "You shall call," in verse 15, "and I will answer you. You will have a desire to the work of your hands. For now you number my steps. Do you not watch over my sin? My transgression is sealed up in a bag, and you show up my iniquity. And surely the mountain falling comes to naught, and the rock is removed out of its place." And he goes on then to talk about his concern. And then that issues forth into the second series of debates, and then the third series of debates, all the way up to chapter 31. But do you get a different sense of Job than you might have had? So, I mean, you read in James 5 and verse 11, it says, "Oh, remember the patience of Job." Oh, yeah, Job was a patient man. Well, that patience has to be arrived at by, we have to develop it. Many people think that God gives us patience. No. We develop it because that's what he wants us to do. He wants us to develop it through the things we suffer, things that we endure. And on the other side of it, patience is there. If you had patience at the start, what would be the point of putting you through something? Well, the person already has patience. So God has to find out, has to determine many things about us. For Abraham, he had to determine whether he would be faithful. For Job, it was whether he would be patient enough to come out in the end to recognize that he had to endure what it was that was confronted upon him. Now, Job was like us all. We don't know, but we seek to know what life is all about. Now, what's really going on? Over in the book of Amos, and I'm going to bring this to a close today because the third sermon is going to be about this young whippersnapper, wet behind the ears, Eliphaz. He's a young man sitting around watching these old guys chew the fat. And we're going to take a look at him because he ushers us into the time that God comes to respond to all that has gone on. So if you turn with me to the book of Amos, chapter 5. When I say that Job is like us and we're like Job and we're going through the things that we are confronted with and we want to know what life is about and why things happen, here's what Amos writes in chapter 5 and verse 4. He says, "For thus says the Lord unto the house of Israel." And of course, he did say that to the house of Israel, but he says it to us as well. "Seek you me, and you shall live." You don't see Job doing a lot of seeking because Job felt that he was righteous. He felt that he was being treated unfairly and unjustly. And what we'll see in the next occasion when God confronts him, that Job comes face to face with some realities about himself that were not apparent when everything was going along and he had everything he needed and everything was smooth. It was when the pressure came that he began to crack. And if he had continued along the path in which he was spouting off before God's confrontation, he would have cracked. It goes on to say in verse 5, "But seek not Bethel." This is talking, of course, about the house of God where Jacob had his pillar stone, where Abraham had erected an ensign. "Not enter into Gilgal and passed into Beersheba." This is really describing the whole lay of the land of Palestine. For Gilgal shall surely go into captivity, and Bethel shall come to naught. Verse 6, seek you the Lord, and you shall live, lest he break out like fire in the house of Joseph and devour it, and there be none to quench it in Bethel. Seek the Lord. Now, that would be a wonderful thing. As a nation, with the tragedies of September the 11th, we began to seek the Lord a little bit more strenuously, didn't we? Now, of course, as human beings, when the pressure's off and things are going pretty well and the stock market's up and people are buying and so forth, we're not seeking as much. And that's human nature. So what can Isaiah tell us? The verse I left out in Isaiah 55, let's go back there, that sets up the idea that our thoughts are not God's thoughts, God's thoughts are not our thoughts, and his ways are not our ways. This is why, in the midst of difficulty and tragedy and suffering, we must seek God and not ourselves. Chapter 55 and verse 6 says, seek you the Lord while he may be found. Call you upon him while he is near. And then it goes on with the verses I started out reading. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. And let him return unto the Lord, and he will have mercy upon him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. What's going to happen as this story unfolds with Job? When God shows up, God condemns the three friends for their poor counsel. They didn't understand what the problem was with Job either. They thought, well, you've got some really bad sins, but they couldn't enumerate anything, they couldn't put their finger on anything, but you must have done something really bad, Job. And so God tells Job later, you pray for your friends because, you know, they're going to need some prayers. You pray for those guys because they were out to lunch in trying to figure it out. But Job couldn't figure it out either. The young man Eliphaz will be introduced to the next time. December the 15th, I think, is the sermon date when I'm up next. That's when part three of this Man of Mystery happens. You can put it on your calendar. And you'll find out that the young man Eliphaz, and this is a wonderful thing about young people. Sometimes we say children should be seen and not heard. And Eliphaz stands by and he listens. He gives respect to the hoary head, the white-haired individuals as they're spouting off and so forth. But every now and then, a young person comes along with some good stuff. I like old Art Linkletter's old show, you know, Kids Say the Darndest Things, because so many of them had some interesting observations they could make about us grown folk, you know. So here's this young man who's going to be given an opportunity to express some thoughts. And he says all of the right things. And that is the introduction to the Almighty Creator showing up at Job's house. Satan came by there too, remember? Took everything he had. Destroyed everything. But if Satan can show up, God can too. And God can make it right. Because Job's latter end was greater than his beginning. And that is why you must endure. You must go through whatever it is that God has for you because he's got something so good for you that it'll put clapping in your hands and shouting in your heart and dancing in your feet where people look around and say, what in the world's happening? God's just blessing because you are enduring to the end.